I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 13th of November, and we should have a rip-roaring, interesting hour coming up. According to our guests, journalists are our chief sense makers, and we need them mostly to help us understand the world of public affairs beyond our direct experience. He's fond of quoting Walter Lippmann, who noted, "Democracy falters if there is no steady supply of trustworthy and relevant news." But journalists may be failing to deliver it. A 2006 Carnegie Corporation report concluded that the quality of journalism is losing ground in the drive for profit, diminished objectivity, and the spread of the entertainment virus. Thomas Patterson is our guest this hour, professor of government and the press at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He has a new and highly interesting book, Informing the News, The Need for Knowledge-Based Journalism. Thomas is also author of The Vanishing Voter, which looks at the causes and consequences of electoral participation, also wrote Out of Order, examining the media's political role, and his first book, The Unseeing Eye, was named by the American Association for Public Opinion Research as one of the 50 most influential books on public opinion in the past half century. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Patterson. We will, of course, ask about the 60 Minutes debacle close to the top of the show because that's front and center right now. But he writes about so many different issues that we're getting our news from partisan sources now. And so where are the facts? And if we don't have facts, do we make informed judgments about issues like war and peace that are crucial to our democracy? This is really a call to action in some ways, and we'll talk more about what knowledge-based journalism is. All hour, we welcome your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Thomas Patterson, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, Kathleen, thank you.
And what a book. I really enjoyed it. And I must say, I got kind of outraged. I was depressed and angry after I read some of this because this is a democracy. We need fact-based journalism. We need to know what's going on, don't we?
We do. And, you know, I think this is an old problem, not a new one. You mentioned Walter Lippmann. He devoted a lot of space in his classic Public Opinion to that very issue. And, you know, journalists over the decades have remarked on the same point. The New York Times' Tom Wicker was said frequently that he thought one of the great weaknesses of journalism was a lack of subject matter expertise, which put them at risk when they talked to other people and took what they said at face value. And so it's an old problem, but I do think it has a new urgency.
Mm-hmm.
One reason is I think sources are less trustworthy today. You know, I hate to say that, but I do think in politics there's more spin than there was in the past, and where there isn't political spin, the public relations firms are spinning the other facts that are coming our way. And then I think public policy is just getting more and more complex. The society gets more complex, and you know that. You know, that poses a burden on the journalist to keep up with an increasingly hard to understand world of society and of public policy. And then the third reason I think that's the case is the you know, there's so many other sources of information out there, and one would like to think that they're telling it to us straight. But you know, talk shows, blogs, they often traffic in outrage rather than rather than information. So if we're going to get good, solid information, the kind of relevant and trustworthy information that Lippmann talked about, you know, journalists are the source that are likely to provide it.
So why is it that we are going more frequently to get our information from people who aren't going to give us information, or they may give us information that's not factual? We go to bloggers, we go to talk show hosts, we go to pundits. Is it that the media is not, other forms of media are not giving us investigative, really in-depth stories, or is it easier for us to go to these people so they can form our opinions for us? What is it?
Well, I think it's all of that and probably more. You know, all of us have a weakness to think that what we think is true.
Right.
And, You know, and that's what talk show hosts really are in the business of, is basically telling us that we're right and the other side is wrong. And, of course, since we can pick our talk show host from one side or the other, you know, we can find what Kathleen Hall Jameson calls an echo chamber. Mm-hmm. You know, and we do have a weakness, a vulnerability for that. Additionally, I think we've lost some of our ability to discriminate between information sources. Part of this is simply that we're flooded with information coming at us from all directions. Another part of it, I think that the news media, to some degree, have degraded their product. You cited the Carnegie Corporation report and, you know, infotainment, the playing up of crime and celebrity and travel and lifestyles and working that in and around the news about government and public affairs. I think that's cheapened the news product, and so we think we have less trust in the press than we had in the past. And as that trust diminishes, then we're kind of more likely to look around, and then we nestle into one of these kind of comfortable places where we're hearing exactly what we'd like to hear.
And yet the consequences can be disastrous. You point early in the book to the possibility of invading Iraq being debated in Washington, pollsters asking people in America for their opinions. And we were willing to go to war depending on what we believed was true of Iraq. And that depended on who we were listening to. And those reports may not have been based in fact. That's frightening.
Well, it is frightening, and when you look at a lot of issues, the levels of misinformation are just astonishing. It was not only Iraq. Right before the invasion, more than half of Americans thought that Saddam Hussein, Iraq's president, and Osama bin Laden were in league, that they were allies, that they were cooperating together in the war on terrorism, and of course they weren't. They were enemies for all sorts of reasons, even though they were both terrorist threats of their own kind to the United States. And but the more you thought that they were working together, the more supportive you were of the invasion. And you look at the debate over the health care reform bill in 2009, 2010, there was a point where roughly half the American public thought that the legislation included death panels, these commissions that would decide whether elderly people at the end of life would be entitled to any more health care. You know, there wasn't any such thing in the legislation. It was never in any draft of the legislation. It's not in the legislation today. And yet, even today, there's a pretty sizable fraction of Americans that think it's in there.
Mm-hmm. You, later in the book, talk about, I wonder sometimes if we become such an entertainment-oriented society that that's what we choose to go to, and we go to people who may be very opinionated, like Rush Limbaugh. Many people see him as an entertainer and fun to listen to. You cite something interesting at the end of the book when you make the case for knowledge-based journalism, and that's whether or not we would even pay attention to stories that were very well done. Can you cite that study, which really showed something that I wasn't aware of, that if we look at our news consumption from 1986 to 2007, it finds that we really are in the hierarchy of stories much more interested in war and peace than we are in what happened to Kim Kardashian or whoever those people are.
Yeah, well, there are a number of studies that point in that direction. Look, there are some people that are attracted to the Kardashian story. There's no question about that. They tend to have some interest in news, but kind of more interest in entertainment. And one of the strategies that, and it was more common on television than in the newspapers, but it was employed by both mediums, was to try to hold on to those people so that you basically soften your news by offering more of that, kind of diminishing it. The problem with that is that kind of weakened the reason why a lot of people were paying attention to news, because they were more interested in the news about you know, current issues and questions of public policy, what's going on in their community and in the country and in the world. And so you diluted the product in that sense. And then there are other studies that show, you know, when you go on the internet, people tend to gravitate toward two types of stories. One is the kind of the instant update. And, you know, all of us kind of have a weakness for kind of being right, you know, up to date on what's
sure.
going on. And, you know, it's most obvious in the case of, let's say, the Green Bay Packers are playing a football game and you're not in front of a television set, but in front of your computer, you know, you might check every 10 minutes to see whether the score has changed or not. And the media are now pretty terrific on keeping us updated, and we all kind of like to be updated. But the other stories that really get traction on the Internet are those really informative pieces. And to continue the sports analogy, you know, if you're going to go after you know the score, even if you've watched the game, what kind of pieces are you going to want to read about the game that you just saw? Those are the ones that are going to dig into and give you the sense of what was really happening out there. And the same thing holds true of politics and public affairs. The what we call the evergreen stories, or the stories that really get passed from one person to the next, you know, tend to be those that really tell us something important.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about what you call the private business with a public trust. Are most news operations really existing because they have to make money? There, of course, are public entities now, but is there an inherent problem with a private business that has a public trust?
Well, there's always that tension, and it's historically been greater in the United States, I think, than in Europe. You know, when television and radio came into the United States, they came in as commercial enterprises by and large. We had a very small public component of it, and with TV, when it came in the 50s and the 60s, you know, it didn't even come in on the. Some of your listeners will be familiar with the old television set that had the channel dialer on it, and it had a VHF
yes,
dial and
sure.
a UHF one, and you couldn't even get the
right.
public. You couldn't get the public television station
right.
on the VHF, which was the easy ones to tune in, right? And it came in as an orphan, and to some degree, it has never been able to catch up. And that's a big sharp contrast with, let's say, the BBC in Europe. So, and I do think that public broadcasting has different values than do the commercial media. And with the commercial media, you know, in their heyday, they were very profitable. In the second half of the 20th century, this was the most profitable sector in the American economy. They were getting about 40% return on capital year after year after year. And then cable comes along and starts to eat into that, and the Internet comes along and starts to eat into those audiences. And, you know, today a lot of newspapers are in trouble. Television is still doing okay, but not nearly as well as it was once doing. And that's when you start to get the real pressures in the newsroom, when the revenues are declining, and particularly when you're hanging by a shoestring. Then you ask the question, not how do I fulfill my civic duty, how do I inform the public, but how do I hold on to my readers, my mm-hmm. listeners, my viewers? And that's a slippery slope. Once you start down that one, it's very difficult to get back and to do good news coverage.
I'm wondering, I know that Walter Lippmann's quotes, and he's so worth reading, I'd like to read a nice biography of him after reading your book. But he's quoted, and he makes a whole lot of sense. I was watching Doris Kearns Goodwin on Stewart's show last night, and she was talking about not only Roosevelt and Taft, but this whole host of journalists, McClure journalists, who she just waxed poetically about and was lamenting the fact that we don't have that kind of journalism now, that they were really, you know, in the business of trying to expose corruption and looking at the workings of government and really dedicated. And people read all of that. You know, it was a golden age. Was it a golden age? Do we need to reflect to a time in the past?
Well, there certainly were aspects of the golden age then. I mean, the muckrakers primarily worked through magazines rather than through newspapers. And, of course, many of the newspapers at that time were in the age of what was called yellow journalism, where they would try to attract the reader by any means possible. So you had both very bad journalism going on and at the same time very good journalism. I think that's still the case today. I don't think there are really bad journalists and good journalists. I think you scratch the skin of almost any journalist and you find someone who's really public-minded. But many of them work under really difficult conditions, declining resources in the newsroom, and then this pressure, essentially, to meet the demands of the mass market. And sort of what goes out the door at that time? Well, the hard reporting, the investigative reporting. You know, the idea in many newsrooms today that you would take three or four of your best reporters and say, here's a problem, or we think there may be a problem that really needs to be looked at, but you're going to have to do a terrific job on it. You're going to have to dig very deep, and we're not going to go with this thing unless you can really get the facts. That may turn out to be a 2 or 3 month assignment. Well, that's a luxury that most news organizations today cannot afford, and so, you know, that really has declined. On the other hand, you know, there are some very good investigative reporters out there like Dana Priest of the Washington Post, who broke the Walter Reed story about essentially the neglect of the soldiers and Marines that were coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and with horrific injuries and basically weren't being tended to in the way that we want our wounded and veterans to be attended to. So there's still some very good journalism of that type. But I think she's right in terms of just the robustness of that part of our journalism. I don't think we can compare with the era she was talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me get your comments and we'll open up phone lines. I don't want them to all be on 60 Minutes. We tend to be people who are keyed into one story and it takes over everything.
Right.
But it is a pretty amazing story because when you talk about investigative reporters and a news operation that was highly respected for so long, what happened to that? What happened here?
Well, you know, I don't know the inside story. And, it's not the first time that they've done that. I mean, Dan Rather lost his job, during the 2000 as a result of a similar kind of incident during the 2004 presidential election campaign over basically what was a phony document that purported to expose George W. Bush's, experience in the National Guard. So they've been through this before. I think it's going to become more common. And the reason I think that's the case is there are increasing pressures because of the competition for audience attention. There's increasing pressures when you think you're onto something and you've got what you think is a really sensational story to go with it before you have an opportunity to really nail it down and to be absolutely sure of your facts. You're always kind of looking over your shoulder, worrying that someone else has been on the same trail and is going to get there before you do. So I think there's a kind of a rush to judgment that we see. And, you know, a good contrast with that is I hold the Bradley Chair here at the Kennedy School, and it's named after Ben Bradley and his family. Ben Bradley was the editor of the Washington Post during the Watergate period. And the Washington Post was 50 stories deep into its Watergate coverage before it had even a single factual error in any of its stories. And, you know, they were working under very difficult circumstances. But he insisted, look, we don't go with something unless we got two people pointing in the same direction. We've got to be sure of our facts. This is too important to get out there and to get out ahead of the facts and essentially be in the rumor business. And but I do think the pressures today on news organizations are such that they've let their guard down in many instances. They rush to judgment. The other thing that's gone out of many newsrooms because of the cutbacks is one of the editorial labor level. So, you know, what's ideal in a newsroom is you've got the reporter working, but then the reporter's work is carefully looked at by an editor, and then there's another editor that looks at that editor's judgments, and you get basically three sets of eyeballs before that reaches out to the public. Well, you look at what's happening today. Many of the, even our best journalists are blogging every 10, 15 minutes. They're putting stuff out to their audience, and there is no filter. There is no check. There is no editorial control. And, they say, well, if I make a mistake, the audience will catch it. Yeah, that's probably true. It will get caught. The only problem is a lot of people will have seen it in its first incarnation. They'll have a piece of misinformation, and they may never see the correction. So, yeah, I do think it. I do think we're in a really difficult cycle in terms of trying to control information to make sure that it is reliable and trustworthy.
And how problematic is it and how widespread is it for these companies to be so large you don't even know who owns what? I was reading today that the book that this guy wrote that's now been withdrawn because it was all lies was on the desk of some newspapers in the country the day after the CBS interview because they're owned by the same company. And ABC having a lot of the stars of whatever their shows are so they could promote what's on entertainment in the evening. Is this highly problematic in your opinion?
Well, I have a mixed opinion about that. I mean, in some ways, the deeper the corporate pockets, the more likely you are to sustain a pretty substantial newsroom and reporting staff. So, that's the benefit of some of these owners. The downside, of course, is that you do, in fact, get some censorship and some cross-promotion out of it. And, sometimes it's pretty severe. And I think the worst case of this was when they were doing the spectrum allocation, when they were going from analog to digital. And, these spectrums were worth billions and billions of dollars.
Goodness.
And, the broadcast industry wanted to get them for nothing, basically, whereas some people were arguing they ought to be auctioned and that money should be put in the public treasury. Well, that was a debate worth having. But if you watched network television, you didn't ever find a story on that particular issue. They just buried that story. They did not want public scrutiny of what they were trying to do behind the scenes in terms of spectrum allocation. So, yes, I do think corporate control can be a problem. I think in the ordinary flow of the way newsrooms operate, there's real resistance on the part of journalists and editors when those fingers reach down from on high into the newsroom. They push back. So I don't think it happens very often, but when it does happen, it matters, and that's why we ought to be concerned about it.
Thomas also writes about the fairness doctrine, and will ask if we need a return to a fairness doctrine in this country and what effect it had on radio and television, particularly to lose that doctrine. Thomas Patterson is our guest this hour. He's Bradley Professor of Government and the Press, teaches at the Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. He's written a number of books, and today we are talking about his latest, Informing the News, The Need for Knowledge-Based Journalism. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to leave a message there, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. He writes, journalists are our chief sense makers. If they're falling down on the job, if we don't have enough of highly qualified, hardworking, good thinking, creative thinking journalists, then we're in trouble, and that we seem to have gone to pundits and bloggers to get our information, which frequently coincides with what it is we think, and sometimes what they say they're doing for entertainment purposes, and we're not having a fact base to our consumption of news, which really can spell huge problems for a democracy. What do you think? We'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open for you at this very moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. Thomas Patterson is our guest. Informing the News is his book, The Need for Knowledge-Based Journalism. And let's go to Lee in Lake Geneva, our first caller. Hi, Lee.
Hi. Mr. Patterson has done a great job of outlining all the factors that have undermined journalism in the last few decades. I'm a retired journalist myself from Chicago, print journalism, and I saw these kids flock into journalism schools right after the Watergate era, destined to be idealistic journalists themselves, only to find out in the 80s that the look at the bottom dollar had print journalism competing with entertainment journalism on TV and radio. And so all those investigative pieces gave way to entertainment pieces and fluff pieces and shorter stories. And even in the even in the electronic journalism, the fairness doctrine got eroded. And till today, there's, I don't know whether there's laziness on the journalism's part or just a lack of funds, but today it seems like the idea of fairness is that you get one Democrat and one Republican, and they just kind of trade opinions, and that's the basis for today's good journalism. It's just a couple of opinion pieces that aren't even based on fact. They can say anything they want to, and it becomes the new fairness doctrine that we're living under today.
And Lee, what kind of reporting did you do?
I did community journalism, as opposed to, you know, it was the local politics, the zoning, the politics, the schools.
Right.
But still, even that got crowded out by...
Yes, it's been very much crowded out.
And again, just as Mr. Patterson pointed out, too, really good journalism requires an oversight of good editors. And when you strip away the editorial staff, there's no one looking over the shoulders of the kids who don't know what they're doing. Mm.
Professor Patterson.
Well, you know, I think Lee speaks from experience here about the changes that have taken place. And I think one of the most dramatic illustrations of that, at one time, if you had a local television station, you had someone assigned to cover City Hall and to talk about the community, at least from the standpoint of the elected community leaders. It's pretty uncommon in a medium-sized city today to find a television affiliate that has a reporter that's basically camped out at City Hall. And state coverage, the statehouse coverage in most states, boy, those have been really hollowed out. Part of that is this entertainment virus that's taken over, and the substitution of stories about what our governments are doing and replaced with stories of celebrity and the like. Some of it also has to do with this resource problem. And, one of Claire's points is about younger journalists. And, there still are kind of our hope for the journalism of the future. But they don't have the mentoring that they once had. So when they come into the newsroom, they're much less likely to be teamed up because the news organization often doesn't have the resources to do anything but to put them in the field right away, and they're covering things that they really don't know very well. And that's the basic theme of the book, is really that journalists too often are telling us about things that they don't properly understand.
Right.
And then there are a number of things that happen as a result of that. We get a lot of coverage of the ballistics of politics, and we get very little coverage of the substance. We had Al Simpson here last night for a talk, and then this morning for a panel. And, the Simpson-Bowles report is really a really hard look at our budgetary issue. And, his complaint about the press is, that you get all sorts of stories about the fight over the budget. You get that from every angle. What you don't get are stories about what's really going on with the budget. And there, I think, is where the observation that Tom Wicker made some decades ago really comes into play. If you don't understand the budget, mm-hmm. you can't really cover the budget issue from the standpoint of what's in the budget and what's at stake there. And you end up then doing the easy story, which is the fireworks that's mm-hmm. around the budget debate.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that, speaking of money issues, in terms of the stimulus funding, that it was probably fairly widespread belief that, oh, the money was wasted, that nobody did any hard digging. It was hard to find that story. Where did all that money go? Oh, it just, it was all wasted money, which really it wasn't. But where was the journalism that let us know where our taxpayer dollars went, for heaven's sake?
Well, it was not only that there wasn't very much journalism of that kind, but there was also and Lee made reference to this, kind of the journalism of what James Fellows has called the journalism of false equivalencies.
Yes.
So that, we get one side saying this and we get the other side
right.
saying that, and they're just trotted out right in front of us, kind of like take your pick, without the journalist making any effort to sort through where the truth might lie. And too often, I hate to say it, neither side is leveling with us. And that's particularly true when it comes to these kind of hard issues about, we may face some cutbacks in programs, or we may face some tax revenues if we're going to get our fiscal house in order. Well, you know, the politicians seem increasingly loath to tell us that, so they tell us myths about what the situation is, and then too often the journalist just passes those myths along to us, and we grab it, whichever one we prefer.
Thanks, Lee. Don emails, I agree we need better, more factual reporting at the local and national levels, but how do we fix it?
Well, it's not an easy fix, and you know, one would, you know, Kathleen, it'd be easier to lay out a fix if news organizations were flush, and you know, but that's 20 years ago. That's not the reality of today. But I think there are a couple of things that can happen, and they're not quick fixes. And nor was the fix of yellow journalism, that really wacky journalism that we had a century ago. That was not a quick fix. That took two or three decades before we put something more substantial in its place. And I think that's what we're talking about here. What I would think about, for instance, you know, I do think increasingly, if you're going to be a news reporter, if you're going to be in the newsroom, you need to have subject matter expertise as well as a knowledge of how to create stories. You know, if you're going to be covering the economy, or if you're going to be covering business, if you're going to be covering the health care sector, you need to know something about that.
That makes sense.
Well,
yeah, it does.
But it is, but it's not so easy, right?
I know.
You know, but newsrooms have smartened up about that, and it's still the case that less than 5% of working journalists have an advanced degree in the subject area, but 5% is better than the 1% of a couple of decades ago. So there's movement in that direction. You know, we're increasingly seeing lawyers, you know, being on the judicial beat, and we're increasingly seeing people trained in economics doing the economics reporting and so on. So I think that direction is there, and I think people understand it has to continue along that line, because they, you know, these issues are really increasingly complicated, and they don't yield easily to the amateur. So you've got to have some understanding of the issues. The place where I think we need to make the most substantial changes are in our journalism schools. They're still working by and large, and they've made advances. I'm not saying they're stuck where they were a century ago or a half century ago, but the process is still pretty much the same. If you're a journalism student, you're taught how to gather the information, how to package it, and how to disseminate it. It's sort of where knowledge fits into that production process is not a regular part of the journalism curriculum. So, you know, you think as a journalism student, by the time you're done, you think if a situation arises, I got to go interview somebody. That's second nature. I've got to go to the site if it's nearby to see what happened at the scene. That's second nature. Do I go and try to really inform myself about this subject before I go much further? That's not second nature. That needs to become part of our training. An example of that, I think, is statistical literacy. You know, it's really hard today to report on what's going on out there if you can't interpret the numbers. It doesn't mean you have to create the numbers, but you've got to be able to interpret them properly. But most journalism schools do not require their students to have statistical literacy. So many of them leave journalism school without really being able to read a balance sheet or to understand government agency reports when they come out, or to interpret polls properly. Now, they report on these things, they give us the numbers, but oftentimes they misinterpret them.
Let's go to Lynn in Eau Claire. Thanks for waiting, Lynn. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. I contacted a television reporter with our ABC affiliate up here concerning some political issue. And I was told that she could report the news but not cover it for fear of losing her job because of corporate pressure. And that's giving us nothing, and it terrifies me.
What was the story, Lynn? What was the story?
Actually, it was it had to do with some Medicaid coverage. I have a disabled child, and the group of friends that we have disabled children, and there were some cuts being made, and we're real people with real problems, and we're pushed aside. That was the particular issue.
Mm-hmm.
And she couldn't, you know, she says, I cannot do what I was trained to do. And I was chosen because a lot of our friends work for the state, and they can't. They can't make waves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I mean, it's heartbreaking because the Fourth Estate, I'm from Chicago, and I remember coverage. I remember in-depth reporting. And the Fourth Estate kept the other three estates in line. And it's frightening to me.
Thomas?
Well, no, I think Lynn has pointed out something. I don't know the particulars of that example, so I'll shy away from that. But I do think there is a lot of timidity in our reporting. You know, there's always safety if you're covering government officials, simply to pass along what they're saying. That's the safe thing to do. You keep your access that way. They're also a source of stories, so you also have your access to a steady supply of stories, as well as when you need the interview to be done, they say, oh, come on. I mean, so it's much easier to go along and to kind of rock the boat if you're a journalist. And I think I don't know whether it's any worse today than it was 20 years ago. It probably varies a lot from market to market and from newsroom to newsroom, but I do think that, journalists increasingly, I think, have to step up and have to, in some ways, if they're going to take the claim to being our sense makers, if they're going to ask for the protections of the First Amendment, then they have to basically use them and use them to serve our interests. And, too often, I think, for example, a journalist will go into and conduct an interview with a public official, and the journalist will know enough to know that that public official is not telling the straight story.
Right.
But they'll report it as it was told to them. That's a disservice not only to us, the audience, but that's a disservice to their profession. And I think we need. But again, here's where knowledge comes into this. If the journalist doesn't know the situation, then they're actually absolutely more inclined to take the official at face value. So they need to know so that they can do the correction and to do it properly. And then they have to have the courage to stand up and say, no, this is where the truth lies in this instance. Some journalists do that. They actually fare pretty well in the long run. I don't think it's something that you could say just runs through every journalist who's out there.
You would think that when you just described that, Thomas, I was thinking, well, isn't that, of course, what journalism is? Isn't that why people go into journalism to do that very thing? Evidently not.
Well, I'll give you an example of the risk. I mean, one of the top jobs in journalism, I think it's actually a pretty boring job, but it's considered to be one of the real plums, is to be the White House correspondent for your news organization. And there are about 200 of them, and of course they hang around the White House, and they get briefed daily by the press secretary and so on. And at one point in the George W. Bush administration, Dana Milbank of the Washington Post said that the Bush administration is wrote a story saying they're playing pretty fast and loose with the facts, and here are some of the facts that they're not telling you, and here are some of the things that they spun that aren't true that they did tell you. Well, what did the White House do? Basically, when he was sitting in the press room and raised his hand, they would never call him.
Mm-hmm.
There's usually a plane full of journalists who travel with Air Force One when the president goes abroad. That's something you want to. That's a plane you want to be on, and he never got invited to be on that plane.
They wouldn't let him on the plane?
They wouldn't let him on
the
plane. So, they have ways to freeze you out.
It's
it's not like this is a risk-free enterprise. He stood up, and he's still there, and he's doing well at the Post. But too many of them are compliant, and until you get a critical mass that basically says we're not going to play this game, then you're going to find people who, in fact, are willing to play it for access and the other things that they get out of it.
Lynn, thanks for the call. We'll take more in a moment. One line is open if you're trying to get through. Thomas Patterson is our guest this hour. He's written a really thoughtful and challenging book to people who are broadcasters and really to American citizens, because We sometimes need to ask for what we want when it comes to information. Informing the News, the Need for Knowledge-Based Journalism is the name of his book. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls, more of them for Thomas Patterson, Larry, and Stevens Point. Hello.
Hi, Kathleen. My comment is actually very supportive of your guest. Back in the I'm a retired economics professor here at UW Stevens Point, and back in the 70s, every time some economic issue would be in the news, the local TV stations and radio stations would send out a reporter to interview me, and it was pretty obvious that these very young reporters really didn't know much about the issues. And they did the best they could. But after a while, I learned that before the interview started, I would ask them, well, are there, can I suggest any questions that you might like to ask me? And they were extremely grateful and appreciative about that. And that really helped, I think, the interview and did make their interview more relevant for the audience.
The only problem with that, Larry, is what if you had, I'm not saying this is the case, but what if you had a strong point of view and politically you were making sure your questions coincided with what your viewpoint was? They wouldn't have known what the truth was, right?
Well, that might be true, but you know, I didn't really have an axe to grind.
No, I understand
so I
tried
that. To be fair.
I understand that, but maybe other people wouldn't have been so forthright and honest as you. People obviously need to know what they're going out to interview somebody. They need to know a bit about the subject matter. It seems to me as though that's just a given, Thomas. Evidently, it's a problem.
Well, I think it is a. I think it's a real problem, and it's more true around economics reporting than around political reporting.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
you know, most journalists can report the political game. I mean, well, we play it even in our conversations with each other. So that's that's not rocket science to be able to talk about who's up and who's down and who's getting the better of whom. But you know, I think to report effectively and on the economy, you have to have some understanding of the economy. If you look, for instance, at the way the American press is portraying the euro crisis, you'd think it's the frugal Germans against the spendthrift Greeks, and or Merkel against Sarkozy or Hollande. You know, that it's but Larry will tell you, I think, that, you know, the problem of the eurozone is a structural one. Their banking system is not at all like ours and is really not equipped to deal with the problems of a union and the economic difficulties that can arise during a downturn in a union of the kind that the eurozone has. And that kind of reporting is really pretty sparse. And we see it here, too, I think, in the lead up to the crash of 2008. In some ways, many of the reporters who were covering the economy were acting as cheerleaders. In fact, were helping inflate that bubble that eventually ended up costing a lot of homeowners their home and cost almost everyone who had a 501k a huge deflation in the value of that. And we really depend on good reporting to be able to make judgments about how we plan for our retirement, how we think about kind of the investments we make, whether we're going to buy a home at this time or not. And we're just not getting that kind of reporting. And I think at base, one of the reasons for it is a lot of the people who are reporting on the economy don't understand the economy very deeply.
Right. Well, Larry, you can always come out of retirement and apply at your television station and you'll know what you're talking about. You mentioned cheerleaders. Let's talk a little bit about cheerleaders and about the fairness doctrine. I've been in radio for years and years and years and worked in it at a time when we had a fairness doctrine. It seemed pretty level-headed to me that you couldn't have all these people who are spouting their opinions all day long on a station. And the kind of show that I do now, I did on commercial radio some years ago. You could never have this kind of show because it's, for the most part, very, very conservative. Guys, for the most part, who are spouting their opinions all day, and they're cheerleaders for certain causes. And maybe I'm just becoming an old fogey, but I think Oh, we used to have such substantial conversations with, you know, all kinds of people with many viewpoints and an audience that was made up of conservatives and liberals and just the American citizenry. What's happened? Do we need a fairness doctrine again, or?
Well, that's a good question, Kathleen. My sense is that cable, which was not governed by the fairness doctrine, and the internet, which is not governed by the fairness doctrine, may have changed the landscape so fully that even if we were to try to put it back into place, it wouldn't have the desired effect. But let me take your listeners back to what the fairness doctrine required of broadcasters. This was a condition of holding the license, was that you had to report on your community. Basically, you had to do public affairs reporting.
Mm-hmm.
That was done away with. And now you have many stations that don't even have a local presence and don't have news at any point during the day. Well, you couldn't do that before the Fairness Doctrine was eliminated. And the other thing the Fairness Doctrine required was not that you balance it minute for minute, but that you had to have balanced coverage, that if you were going to report, have a talk show that was a conservative talk show, you had to have a liberal talk show that was ran in roughly the same kind of place in the daily schedule, so that people had the opportunity to hear both sides. And that actually kind of inhibited a lot of radio stations from doing talk radio, because they might have wanted a liberal one, they didn't want the conservative, or vice versa. You got rid of the fairness doctrine, and all of a sudden that part of our information system just exploded. It is less about information than it is about attracting an audience. And Glenn Beck once said that half the formula for being a successful talk show host is to be like a rodeo clown. In some ways, you got to pull people in.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other part is basically outrage. You know, you appeal to people's instincts, their basic values. You demonize the other side. If you're looking for a prime culprit for why levels of information have risen so highly, and I'm talking only within the media system. There's a lot of stuff going on in the political system that supports this, and also why, you know, we misunderstand and don't like the other side. I don't think you have to look much harder than at partisan talk radio.
Or absolutely.
Not everyone in that business, but many in that business.
Jim in Lake Geneva, hi.
Hi, Kathleen, and hi, Tom. This is a great show. I think that, being one of those old fogies, as was mentioned, I believe that a lot of the environment and heredity of where we came from. I remember a time in Chicago when there were five papers, and my dad took the Daily News, and as a kid, I delivered the Times.
Oh.
And then the Tribune was there, but I'd never seen a Tribune in our house. And it was something that we were blue collar, and the Daily News was a blue collar paper, and it reported on labor, and that is one thing that I think is really absent in the reporting today, is condition of labor and situations of labor, and I miss that. But then I don't read the newspaper. I'd go to the New York Times, and I will usually read that in the library.
Mm. Thanks, Jim, for the call. We used to read the newspaper. You write about that. There was a time when that's what we did.
Well, you know, Lippmann called it our Bible.
Right.
It was the only book we read every day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think he was right. And all the studies show that, you learn the most from reading. The ear is not quite as good as the eye when it comes to picking up information, and of course you can read much more quickly than words will come at you through the air, whether on radio or television, so you can consume a lot more information in a shorter period of time. We do less of that. But I do think that Jim has really put his finger on a change in journalism that I do think relates to easy journalism. What's easy in journalism is to report on what's happening in Washington at the center, to engage in reporting on the food fight. And what's dropped out increasingly are this really good reporting on these various sectors of American society, including labor. In many newsrooms, it's hard to find a labor correspondent.
Right.
Even in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and you see other examples of this, of you know, just kind of missing pieces of our daily lives are not being covered. And you know, I do think that what we have to do is get journalists, and I think this is where better trained, more knowledgeable journalists come into play. If you know a subject area, you see it differently.
Right, and on that note, that's a good way to end, because we have to. Thomas,
thank you.
No, thanks so much. It was a great hour.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, talk again. Thomas Patterson, it really is a good book to read. Informing the News, The Need for Knowledge-Based Journalism. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the show, to Robin Cherry for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up from NPR, and we'll return, so stay with us. Sorry we didn't get to all your calls.